I'd like to welcome everybody to the lecture today. Mesdames et messieurs, je vous souhaite la bienvenue. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the fourth installment of the Andrew F. Olms Dean of Medicine Distinction Lectures. For those of you who may not know me, my name is Philippe Gros, and it says here that I am the Vice Dean of Life Sciences in the Faculty of Medicine here at McGill. It is my pleasure to serve as your host today. On behalf of Dr. Heidelman, the Dean of Medicine, who is unable to be here today. We're honored to host this lectureship in Dr. Holmes' name, McGill Faculty of Medicine First Dean, to provide a forum for our larger community for stimulating academic exchange. Made possible through the generosity of late Rosie Weiselberger, the lectures salute those who are outstanding in the health sciences while celebrating the scholarship that is the backbone of all we do in education, research, and healthcare at McGill. They also open the doors to our undergraduate students, graduates, and postdocs to give them the opportunity to learn from and exchange with the luminaries that define excellence in the health sciences. I am excited to have our illustrious speaker with us, who I will introduce in just a moment. At the end of our talk, Dr. Morag Park, professor in the Department of Oncology and the Department of Biochemistry and director of the Rosalind and Morris Goodman Cancer Research Center, has graciously accepted to moderate our questions and answer period. Without further ado, allow me to introduce today's distinguished guest lecturer. Currently the DaCosta Professor of Biological Sciences at Columbia University, Dr. Carol Priebus, earned both her BSc and PhD right here at McGill. After postdoctoral training at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and at the Weizmann Institute, she became a faculty member at the Weizmann prior to joining the biological science departments at Columbia University, where she was appointed to a named professorship in 1995 and served as the department chair between 2000 and 2004. Since the late 1980s, her work has focused on the P53 tumor suppressor protein, the product of the most frequently mutated gene in human cancer. Recently, her laboratory examined P53 proto-oncogene activities in breast cancer cell line using a 3D culture protocol, where she showed that mutant P53 protein increases level of the enzyme that regulates cholesterol biosynthesis and that sustains, and that statins, excuse me, effectively reduce growth of cancer cells with mutant P53. Dr. Priebus has served as chair of both the experimental virology and the cell and molecular pathology study sections at NIH. She has been a member of numerous advisory boards, including the Dana-Farber Cancer Center and the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, among others. Dr. Priebus has received numerous honors and awards, the most recent of which being the AACR Women in Cancer Research Charlotte Friend Memorial Lectureship Award. Tomorrow, she will be among 14 people receiving an honorary doctorate from McGill University during our 2014 convocation. We're deeply honored to welcome Dr. Priebus home at McGill with us today. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Priebus.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. It's such an honor to be asked to give the Holmes Lecture. It's such an incredible honor to be getting this degree tomorrow. It's really incredibly meaningful because, indeed, I am a product of McGill University and of Montreal, and my heart has never left the city or this university. So I changed the title of my talk. For what it's worth. And I'm just looking to see if I have a... Oh, here it is. And what I'm going to talk to you about today, first I'm going to give you a background about P53. Then you stole a little bit of my thunder because I'm going to talk a bit about our work on P53 and cholesterol biosynthesis. And then I'm going to talk about some new findings about a potential connection between P53 and aging. As the years have gone by, and certainly in more recent times, a lot of our research has been informed by clinical data on either cancer patients. We all know that there are multiple databases, the Cancer Genome Atlas, Cosmic, and many others that have been very, very helpful in basically extending and validating findings in basic research, and of course, conversely and very dramatically, findings in basic research are very important for those who are generating the massive amount of data that's now available and to be analyzed. So I'm going to talk a bit about that. But then I'm going to talk about a very different kind of patient database. It basically is a database consisting of one patient. And so, and that patient has been very informative, I believe, to give us a new look at P53 in a condition of called premature aging. So let me get started. Because sometimes I don't finish my seminars, I thought it would be very useful to actually give the most important slide of all, which is the actual people in my lab who did the work. They not only did the work, very often it was their idea. I just, you know, sort of helped them write their papers. Other times I actually did contribute. and I just circled the people that will whose work I will be describing. This is Sungwon Moon, who will be talking about some new findings on P53 and cholesterol biosynthesis. Kaushik Raghunath, who is a computational biologist. Neil Pfister, I actually won't talk about his work, but he is very interested in what mutant P53 does. And Danny Wu and Yen Zhang are the ones who have contributed to our work on aging. So let me get started. This is perhaps not new to too many of you, but we know that P53 is a major tumor suppressor because nearly all cancers have either mutated P53 or somehow found a way to bypass the various activities in cells that P53 mediates. We know also from studies in mice, and these are probably the most definitive, that P53, at least in mice, is absolutely a tumor suppressor. If you delete the P53 alleles, the mice will get cancer with 100% frequency. We also know from human patients that there are these Lee-Fermani families, so named after the epidemiologist who first identified this syndrome, at least put a name to the syndrome, that there are families that have a very high predisposition for coming down with many kinds of cancer at relatively young ages, and many of these family members have germline mutations in P53. And their tumors, when analyzed, have lost the wild-type allele and just retained the mutant allele. And finally, my favorite line of evidence is that multiple tumor viruses have evolved to actually abrogate P53, and I should add to this adenovirus. In fact, I'll change my slide as soon as the lecture's over. And I think other viruses as well. And in fact, it's the tumor viruses that really have, I think, really set the stage for P53. And in fact, P53 was first discovered as a function of people studying SV40 and showing that the large T antigen binds to this protein, which was at the time considered very mysterious. And of course, one has to always pay homage to the media, and now and then over the years, P53 has found itself a star. It was once named the Molecule of the Year by Science Magazine. It was once on the cover of Newsweek. This was a long time ago. But just about a little over a year ago, Gina Collada at the New York Times actually wrote an article that I didn't know what the article was about until I started to read, and it actually was all about P53. And the idea was that if one could find a way to harness the activity of wild-type P53, so it would kill tumors one way or the other, one would have a much broader spectrum approach than a very targeted type of therapy, because P53 is so pervasive in so many different kinds of cancer. So The P53 was discovered, as I said, in the late 1970s by actually a number of groups, most prominently Arnie Levine and David Lane. I would say after that, for about 10 years, the P53 field wandered in the wilderness because people really did not know what this protein was. Depending on the source of the P53 gene, it was either oncogenic or it was not oncogenic. And there was a lot of confusion. It turned out that when people actually got together, one of the first P53 meetings, they lined up their sequences, and no two sequences were alike. It was mutated depending on the source. And then things became much clearer towards the end of the 1980s when Bert Vogelstein, during his search for genes that are lost in cancer, that predispose to cancer, discovered that one of the most frequently deleted regions and mutated regions was chromosome 17 of the human genome. And around that time, Arnie Levine and also Moshe Oren were doing experiments showing that the wild type, the P53 actually isolated from normal, non-transformed cells, could actually suppress the ability of oncogenes to transform cells in culture. So that kind of sparked a very strong interest in this protein. We got into the act around that time. Actually, we got into the act out of sheer cowardice on my part, which is I was very interested in how SV40 T antigen replicates the viral DNA, and I realized that I'd have to be insane to compete with the really outstanding enzymologists who were actually studying this system. And I realized that none of them really were focusing on the fact that T antigen is actually bound to P53. And so I thought maybe we can figure out how P53 is working in this. We identified ways to purify the P53 protein, published a paper. Bert Vogelstein contacted me when he saw the paper. He was very interested in being able to do biochemistry on P53, and we started a collaboration that very soon revealed as a result of his work and our work, that P53 is a sequence-specific DNA binding protein. And we and several others subsequently found that it's a sequence-specific transcriptional activator. Of course, other people were already working furiously on it, and this slide actually sums up a lot of what's known about how wild-type P53 is regulated. It turns out that it's a major stress response factor. Many different kinds of signals, extending from hyperproliferative signals to various forms of DNA damage to metabolic stress as a result of starvation and so on, all impinge on a circuit that consists of P53 and its negative regulator, MDM2, and MDM2's partner in crime, MDMX. The reason it's a circuit is that MDM2 is a transcriptional target of P53. So in a normal, unstressed cell, P53 induces MDM2, which then both represses P53 directly by binding to it and preventing it from being a transcription factor, and it also induces its degradation. So the focus of all of these circuits is to one way or another disrupt the interaction between P53 and MDM2. As a result of this, P53 gets both stabilized and activated, and it then activates the real effectors of its functions in cells. These are its transcriptional targets that themselves have a myriad of different cellular outcomes that they activate. So shown here are just single genes, but there are many more. There's about, I'd say, 200 different P53 targets that have been identified that are fully validated, and that is that they contain P53 binding sites. P53 binds to them, activates them, and they're not activated in P53 null cells. There are probably hundreds more waiting out there. As a result of this, P53, as a result of all these things, can do very good things, and that's what it's most famous for. It's very critical in tumor suppression. I'll describe this in greater detail in a moment. It's been plays a role in stem cell modulation, even fertility, but also P53 has been implicated in many kinds of, let's say, degenerative diseases where tissue is actually either arrested or not dividing properly is arrested and so on. So understanding the good things that P53 does and how to maintain that, or understanding the bad things it does and how to prevent that, are clearly of importance. So why do we all study this? This is sort of sums it up. This was done by Kaushik Raghunath in the lab. He simply looked at the bioporter of all the different cancer genes, discovered that of all these very famous tumor suppressor genes, by far P53 is mutated the most frequently, but perhaps in a more broad scale, Magali Olivier in Lyon lined up 125 of the most frequently mutated cancer genes, both oncogenes and tumor suppressors, and P53 is the clear winner of this, and by matching it with 36 tumor types. So this is why we work on P53. It turns out, however, that P53 mutation is not broad spectrum. It varies enormously with the tumor type. In some kinds of cancers, for example, serous ovarian cancer, almost 100% of the tumors have mutant P53. Lung cancer, colon cancer, very high frequency of mutant P53. But at the other end, there are cancers such as cervical cancer, which is probably largely the result of papillomavirus infection. Interesting, melanoma has very low frequency of P53 mutation. So again, there's a lot to learn about when P53 needs to be mutated and when it doesn't. What we do know about P53, and this is what's fascinating and what keeps the field very, very excited, is that the mutation of P53 is different from the way other tumor suppressors are mutated. So the operational definition of a tumor suppressor is that its activity, its gene, has to be somehow lost or very, very down-regulated in order for a cancer to proceed. In other words, it's protecting the cell from becoming cancerous. And so this is normally the result of either deletion of the gene or mutations within the gene such that only a very unstable protein fragment is made, and so on, or hypermethylation of the genome, so that of the gene promoter, so that the RNA cannot be expressed. What's different about P53, and you can see this from the green here, is that the very great majority of mutant forms of P53 are missense mutations. That means that the protein is still made. And indeed, in the case of P53, these proteins are often present at extremely high levels in tumors. And this is partly because one of the things that these tumor-derived mutations have lost is the ability to bind to DNA and activate transcription. And one of the major targets of P53 is MDM2, which normally degrades P53. So now you have lost your ability to degrade P53, and the protein becomes much more stable. The other thing that's unique about P53 mutations is that they're clustered in this region over here. This is the highly conserved DNA binding domain of the protein. And as you can see, virtually every amino acid, about 8,000 tumors have now been sequenced. And the vast majority of the mutations are located here. And among these are these hotspot mutations that occur with extremely high frequency. They together add up for about 50%, 40 to 50% of the different forms of P53 mutations in cancer. So, with that background, I'd like to propose, and I'm certainly not alone in this, there's actually a very active mutant P53 field, that these mutant P53s are not neutral in cells, they actually promote cancer. In other words, in its wild-type form, P53 is a tumor suppressor, but in its mutant form, it's actually an oncogene. And so here's the evidence for it. First, as I said, mutant P53 is expressed at very high levels in tumors. And indeed, there are some studies that correlate these levels of P53 with poorer prognosis. Li-Fermani patients, the ones I just described to you, usually have missense mutations, but occasionally they have null mutations. And it turns out the ones with missense mutations, with some degree of statistical significance, it's a little bit questionable, have a significantly earlier onset of tumors than those with loss of P53. The mice have been very informative. As I said, when you knock P53 out of a mouse, they get cancer with 100% certainty, but they get mostly lymphomas and sarcomas. If you instead introduce into the same locus a mutant form of P53, now you're expressing P53 protein, but it's a mutant, you actually see some other kinds of cancers, carcinomas, and they can metastasize. So this is pretty strong evidence, genetic evidence for a gain of function. Finally, experiments in cells, such as many laboratories, including ours, and I'll show you some of these, have shown that mutant P53 activity is associated with behavior of cells that's consistent with oncogenesis, such as invasion, motility, and so on. So this is just from a review that Will Friedprasser wrote. I'll be describing his work in a moment. These are some of the hypotheses for how mutant P53 might work. So actually, Charles DeComo and Christian Guédon in my lab were the first to propose that one of the things mutant P53 does is actually repress the two P53 cousins, P63 and P73, that are sort of like tumor suppressor, I don't know how to say it exactly. They play a sort of a supporting role in the tumor suppression. They're not major tumor suppressors themselves, but they have a little bit of the function of wild-type P53. And we and several others have now shown that in certain settings, even in mice, mutant P53 can actually down-regulate their activity. But mutant P53 could also interact with transcription factors. Several have been shown to interact with mutant P53. There is at least one study that shows that mutant P53 has the ability to recognize unusual structures in DNA, and people have found several proteins that bind to mutant P53 and not wild-type P53 that could account for its activity. So I'm going to tell you first a published study. That's the work of Will Friedprasser, who's probably the best student that ever worked in my laboratory, which is, in a way, saying a lot. I've had some wonderful students. He was an MD, PhD student. He's now doing his residency at Mass General. I gave him some of the original ideas, but he really ran with it. And I like to talk about his qualities because I think they should be inspirational for anybody who wants to become a scientist. So one of the things you need to be able to do is to be excited about your work, and you have to work hard. We know this. But there's a couple of other, I think, attributes that young people should try to develop. One of them is to read widely, read the literature, make sure you're up with the latest developments, and Will did that. And the other thing is, if you know what's an interesting question, and you know what you would need to do it, and you yourself can't do it, then reach out and find the right collaborators so that you can get the question you're interested in answered. And as you can see from this long list of people, many of these were people that Will contacted himself, or he nagged me to contact in order so that he could get the experiments done. So there's a long list here, and I'll start with Mina Bissell and her student Aaron Boudreau. It was Mina who, several years ago, and she's a very well-known woman, first discovered that if you plate non-malignant cells in laminin-rich extracellular matrix, they don't spread out and just grow as they do as a sort of a monolayer on plastic dishes. Rather, they form little spheres, and these are referred to as mammospheres. And as the experiment proceeds, the center of this sphere hollows out, the cells in the middle die, and the cells on the external part that are the remaining layer of cells that form this sphere, or this hollow sphere, acquire apical basal polarity. And in some ways, this whole process replicates the development of the basic unit of the breast, which is the duct. And they're sometimes referred to as acinar-like structures. So Will set up, and he did this experiment, and I should say that another scientist, Joan Ruge at Harvard, took advantage of Mina's system and did some extremely beautiful work, working out a lot of the genes that are involved in this and how those genes, when mutated, can lead to breast cancer. Mina had also discovered something quite important. As I showed you before, those are non-malignant cells. They're not cancer cells. When she tried to do the same 3D, these are called 3D cultures, when she tried to do them with any number of about 25 different breast cancer cell lines, she discovered that they don't form these beautiful acinar-like structures. Rather, they form very different kinds of malignant, disordered, sometimes invasive-looking structures in this culture medium. She referred to these as, for example, grape-like or stellate. And the reason I'm showing this slide is that these two cell lines each contain one P53 gene, and that gene is a hotspot mutation. They don't contain any wild-type P53. So that allows us to ask, is that mutant P53 in these cells actually playing a role in this very malignant morphology? And we were about to set up a situation where we could basically ablate the P53 in those cells when we discovered that Jill Barganetti at Hunter College, who actually was once a postdoc in my lab several years ago, it was she who discovered that P53 binds to DNA, had basically done that experiment. She had engineered these cells to express a doxycycline-inducible shRNA that ablates P53, or at least knocks it down. So this is an example of that. This is the mutant P53 in the cell being greatly reduced when you introduce doxycycline. Now, if in the presence of full amounts of mutant P53, the vast majority of cells in this particular cell line have these either very disordered or malignant-looking morphology in the 3D culture. A tiny fraction, 2 to 3%, had hollow lumens. But strikingly, when we knocked down mutant P53 in these cells, we got the cells from Jill collaboratively, this tiny fraction became over 50% of the little structures we were seeing in 3D cultures. And you can see here what they looked like. In other words, this implied that having high levels of mutant P53 is required for maintaining the malignant morphology of these cells. And in fact, Will confirmed this by putting back into these cells an shRNA-resistant version of the same mutant and showing you no longer could get this reversion to malignant morphology. So he then did what most people would do. He set up a collaboration, because we weren't set up to do it, in order to see what genes were being regulated when you knock down mutant P53. And it turned out that a lot of them were, about 1,000. About 700 were upregulated, and about 500 were downregulated. so that's a lot of genes. And so, in fact, that's a lot of things to be able to do in the future. What we then did was to take that data and subjected it to two different kinds of pathway analysis, one of which is ingenuity pathway analysis, and to our big surprise, the pathway that was mutated with the highest lighting, I don't know if I'll need it anymore. We'll see. Over here? Now it's really dark. Bad idea. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. It may not matter as much. Well, I guess it'll matter. Is it better? No, it's not.
The whole thing?
I doubt it. Yeah. I may have to ask you test questions afterwards to make sure. All right. So anyways, he did find this amazing thing. I just want to point out that there were about 15 other pathways. A lot of them actually were ones you might predict. They were things with, I know I can hardly read it here, cell, I can't remember. Whatever. They were very important. At any rate. this is the pathway that we focused on. Look, it's sort of head and shoulders above the others. Will then validated the these results by doing the experiment himself, knocking down mutant P53, looking at a bunch of genes. So what is this pathway? This pathway is the result, the Nobel Prize winning work of Brown and Goldstein, who did extraordinary work studying how cells synthesize cholesterol, and their work led to the development of the blockbuster drugs, the statins, that I bet some people in the audience take, including yours truly. And statins block the rate-limiting step in this process, which is the conversion of HMG-CoA to mevalonic acid. And that's why it's referred to as the mevalonic acid pathway. This pathway consists of a series of genes whose products are involved for various aspects of the ultimate formation of cholesterol, which itself is a precursor of important other hormones such as vitamin D and others. It's also the source of major other molecules that are involved in association with proteins, linkage to proteins such as farnesylation and geranylgeranylation, which allows certain proteins such as RAS and RAS family members to bind to the cell membrane. So it has many important byproducts, including, of course, the synthesis of cholesterol, which is needed for membrane rigidity. So Will, being a medical student, immediately had the idea to see whether statins themselves have any impact on the ability of these cells to grow in 3D culture. So these are these two cell lines that I've told you about that have only mutant P53. And what he discovered was that two different lipophilic statins, one of which is shown here, had the ability to greatly inhibit the appearance of these very disordered structures in the 3D culture. Furthermore, he could prevent this by putting into the culture, along with the statin, mevalonic acid, which is the target of the drug. So that implicated this pathway in the impact of statins on the growth of these cells in the 3D culture protocol. He then worked with Jose Silva at our medical school to introduce tumors into mice from this cell line and show that if you treat the cells, the mice with these statins, their tumors grow much more slowly. He then showed that, and I really love this experiment, that if you knock down mutant P53, as I showed you before, and you now revert many of these clusters to acinar-like morphology, he prevented this by putting mevalonic acid into the culture. So that implicated this pathway in the ability of mutant P53 to maintain the malignant characteristics of these cells in 3D culture. So how does this work? So again, the work of Brown and Goldstein has told us that this pathway is a really extraordinarily coordinately regulated pathway. There are essentially two transcription factors called sterile response element binding proteins that regulate this pathway. So how it works is, and I'll be coming back to this in a little while, these proteins are found in the ER. They're there present as large inert precursor proteins. When cells are depleted of cholesterol, that triggers a signal whereby via this chaperone they are moved to the Golgi, where they are then subjected to two proteolytic cleavages leading to the release of basic helix loop from their end termini, which go to the nucleus and bind to sterile response elements, a specific sequence that they can interact with. And at that point, they then activate every one of these genes in the pathway. Since mutant P53 activated most of the genes in the pathway based on Will's analysis, he developed and we developed the hypothesis that the way this works is that mutant P53 can associate with SREBPs, we think specifically SREBP2, and as a result of that, this hyperactivates the sterile biosynthesis enzyme, leading to this misspelled 3D morphological phenotype. If there's less mutant P53, you get less activation of the sterile biosynthesis sterile biosynthesis enzymes, and now you get this phenotypic reversion to the more normal-like structures in this system. And so I'm not going to show you all our lines of evidence. It's admittedly a circumstantial case, but I think it's reasonable to at least think that part of what we're seeing is a result of an interaction of mutant P53 with SREBP at these promoters. This is a chromatin immunoprecipitation, and this is, in each case, the first bar is with full levels of mutant P53, knockdown mutant P53, and a control. And you can see that several of these genes have mutant P53 present at the promoter. This is now a sort of a low-resolution scan of the HMG-CoA reductase promoters, and you can see a peak of mutant P53 here. I should say this result tells me that there's more to it than meets the eye, in the sense that I think that there's a general interaction of mutant P53 with chromatin, and that this is just an added thing that mutant P53 does, and we're kind of working on that now. But I think a critical experiment that Will did was to knock down SREBP and show that you got less mutant P53 associated under these conditions. So this supports his hypothesis. So does this have anything to do with real human cancer? And so for this, we set up a collaboration with Annalisa Borsen-Dale, who operates out of Norway, and she has about data, full gene expression data from 800 different breast cancer patients. And therefore, she was able to work with Will, or her people were able to work with Will, to see if they could show a correlation of mutant P53 and these different enzymes that are part, these genes encoding the enzymes that are part of the cholesterol biosynthesis pathway. And as you can see, this is a heat map with the highest expression over here, and there was a pretty striking correlation of those genes that were overexpressed with those tumors that had the highest rate of P53 mutation. In fact, there was even a correlation with patient survival data. Those patients that had the highest amount of these enzymes tended to have worse survival than those that had the lowest levels of these enzymes. So whether or not mutant P53 is a direct driver of this, I think this tells one that having very high levels of these genes expressed, of expressed genes, is something that one should be considering as part of a diagnostic tool for cancer. So this is a recent analysis that Kaushik did in our lab. Just to confirm what Annalisa found with her data set, Kaushik went in and looked at the Cancer Genome Atlas and essentially made the same discovery. So this is a totally different set of patient data sets. This is what we found in our paper that we published. But when Kaushik looked in the TGCA database, he basically saw something very similar. Many of the genes involved in the cholesterol biosynthesis are present much higher in mutant P53 than in wild-type P53-expressing tumors. And he even got a correlation with missense mutations, and even got a correlation to some extent with hotspot mutations, but the number of those patients with hotspot mutations was probably somewhat below the number needed for real statistical power. So that's what I'm going to tell you about with respect to mutant P53. I think the questions that lie ahead are very important ones. As I mentioned before, about 1,000 genes are affected by mutant P53, and the questions are, are they all unique? I mean, does mutant P53 do 1,000 different things? And I find that hard to believe. There must be some kind of a common mechanism, and we're working on that. I added this because I'm going to tell you something in a moment. What's the difference between wild-type P53 and mutant P53 with respect to this? What targets of P53 are needed for its ability to promote some of the activities in cells like invasion and migration and metastasis. And a question I'm always asked is, do different P53 mutations have unique outcomes in tumors? And we don't know the answer yet. And then can we harness this knowledge for therapeutic purposes? People have been working on this for a long time. For example, Klaus Weimann and Galina Selivanova in Sweden have identified a small molecule that they believe can actually convert a mutant back to wild type. Our data would indicate that if you knew the pathways that P53 activates, could we just go after those pathways? And statins might be a very interesting way to start considering that kind of an approach. And finally, because there's such a correlation between the levels of mutant P53 and its ability to be oncogenic, can we identify ways to degrade mutant P53 so that its levels will be lower and therefore it will be less oncogenic? So I'm going to leave you with that, but I'm going to go on, running out of time a little bit here, to talk about some work that was done by and postdoc in the lab, Sungwon Moon. So this is what we know from the literature. Very often those genes that are activated by wild-type P53 are inhibited by mutant P53, and vice versa. Very often mutant P53 targets that have been identified are actually repressed by wild-type P53. So Sung Wan's question is, could wild-type P53 be modulating this pathway? I'll go through his data very quickly so I can get on to our aging story. And what he discovered was that if you introduce wild-type P53, it actually inhibits several of these enzymes. This is using overexpression. Here in this case, you're activating endogenous P53. In the famous HCT cells that contain or lack P53, Nuttlin, which is a very important activator of P53 by preventing it from interacting with MDM2, leads to reduced expression of these genes only when there's P53 present and not when it's absent. And more physiologically, if you induce expression of these genes by depleting sterols from the medium, you get a big increase in expression only if P53 is absent and not if it's present. Furthermore, you can show that the SREBP is bound to HMG-CoA much more when P53 is absent than when P53 is present. So how does this work? This is where we got a big surprise. We assumed we would see some gene that was affected by P53, and indeed it might still be a gene. But what we discovered was, and so we looked, again, I want to remind you that here's how these proteins are regulated, the SREBPs, large precursor, cleavage upon depletion of sterol, presence of cleaved product in the nucleus, and then they're actually degraded. So what Sungwon found was, interestingly, that the actual cleavage process, the appearance of the mature form, is much more prevalent in the absence of P53 than in its presence. And because you get the same result with a proteasome inhibitor, this means it's the cleavage as opposed to the degradation that's affected. And how this works is something that we're still working on. I should say we've done this in different ways. This is in the P53 temperature-sensitive cells, where you have P53 at wild type only at 32 degrees. You see less of the protein. You overexpress it. You see it much less when there's P53 present. And we know this is now working via one of P53's main transcriptional targets, P21, because in cells that lack P21, you see a much greater amount of the mature form than in cells that have wild-type P53. In fact, it's even more than P53 null cells. And similarly, if you knock down P21 in another cell line, you see significantly more of the mature form. So somehow, P53 via P21 is repressing, essentially, the ability of the precursor SREBPs to become the mature form. We don't know how that works, but it's, I think it's something to focus on. And it tells us essentially that this pathway is regulated both negatively by wild type P53 and, as I showed you before, positively by mutant P53. There is some recent paper published by Yossi Yarden and his colleagues in Israel that have implicated P53 in a very important mid-G1 checkpoint, and this involves essentially dampening the expression of these sterile response genes, and we think this may be part of the P53's function in cells, is to keep that those pathways from essentially going out of control. So this is our hypothesis for this part of the talk, which I will finish very quickly. Wild type P53 is normally dampening this pathway to keep it from being too active, to keeping perhaps the cells from becoming addicted to it. Loss of P53 increases the level of these enzymes, but mutant P53 essentially adds even more expression to these cell lines. And so you're getting both the impact of loss of wild type and further activation because of this activity of mutant P53. And I should say that we're working on similar other pathways, and we invariably see this yin-yang relationship between wild-type P53 and mutant, which I think sort of is a clue to trying to understand some basic activities of P53 in cells, which I can discuss later if you want. So this is, I just showed you databases with hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. Now I'm going to show you a database of one patient, which might raise some eyebrows, but it's still pretty interesting. So this is the work, actually, that we were contacted a few years ago by Devorah Lessel and Christian Kubisch, who were at the University of Ulm. They're human geneticists. And this is also a collaboration with Junko Oshimo at the University of Washington. And the person who's done a lot of really nice work on this is a graduate student, Danny Wu, working with two other lab members, Ken Henner-Katz and Yen Zhu. So they contacted us because they had been working with a Werner syndrome database. I just want to remind you, before I tell you this, but that MDM2 functions to repress P53 in collaboration with MDMX by either ubiquitinating P53, leading to its degradation, mono-ubiquitinating it, leading to its export, or directly binding to P53 and preventing it from activating transcription. So the reason I'm telling you this is that they contacted us because they had found that patients, and I will say there were more than one patient, there were actually three, two of whom were related to each other, that had no obvious mutations in any other genes that predisposed to prematurely aging, but they had mutations in MDM2. So I just want to remind you here that P53 has many potential outcomes in cells, and one of them would be essentially causing things like senescence, stem cell erosion, pro-oxidant, when it's particularly active, and these are all consistent with some of the characteristics of cells associated with aging. The first discovery of the role for P53 in aging was actually made by mistake. It was made by Larry Donhauer and his colleagues over 10 years ago when they were trying to make a mouse with mutant P53, and somehow it didn't work, and they ended up with a mouse that had one wild-type allele and one truncated wild-type allele. And they followed this mouse for a while, and the mouse had two extraordinary characteristics. First, it had a lot of it. First of all, it basically didn't get cancer at all. So in contrast to mice who just normally have a certain sporadic cancer rate, these mice had very, very low cancer rates for their age-controlled cohort. But the other characteristic of these mice is that they developed a lot of the characteristics of really aging animals, including, for example, osteoporosis and several other aspects. Their fur was more gray or white, and they had various other characteristics as well. So this was a very striking finding. It implied that there's a sort of, again, a yin-yang between aging and cancer, which has attracted many people thinking about this over the years. Then other mouse models were made. Heidi Scrabel this time didn't make a mistake. She deleted the N-terminus from mice, got the very similar result, although these mice were not particularly free of cancer. And then Steve Jones and his colleagues deleted MDM2 in the epidermis and found that these cells had, of course, by deleting MDM2, they had much higher levels and more active P53. The skin of these mice had accelerating aging phenotypes. But it's not so simple. Manuel Serrano and his colleagues generated mice with an extra P53 gene, and these mice, which he called super P53 mice, didn't get cancer as frequently, but they didn't have signs of aging. And Mary Perry generated a mouse with low levels of MDM2, had high levels of P53, but these mice also didn't accelerate aging. So the question is this playing any role in human cancer? And it turned out that there are these three patients, and I'm going to be focusing on one of them, that by, for some politically incorrect way, which we've changed, they refer to as Saudi. This person actually has two siblings that have already died, and I think this is a little older, so I don't know what the status of this is, but they have a lot of characteristics of premature aging consistent with progeria, which is an official name for this kind of a syndrome. Progerioid patients have very unique characteristics. They're short, prematurely gray hair. They very often have diabetes, atherosclerosis, a lot of the characteristics of aging people, cataracts and so on. There are some genes that have been shown to be associated with progeria. The most famous is lamin A. A mutation in lamin A is very highly correlated. I think it's called Hutchison-Gilford syndrome. I tend to not remember the name properly. Another syndrome is a mutation in the Werner's gene, which plays a role in DNA repair. And it was through the Werner's registry in Seattle that they found patients which had what they called atypical Werner's syndrome characteristics, in that they didn't have mutations in Werner's. And when our colleagues actually sequenced their DNA, it was then that they found that they had mutations in MDM2. So patients 2 and 3, which I'm not going to talk about, are heterozygotic. They have one wild-type MDM2 and one mutated MDM2, and their mutation in MDM2 is in the N-terminus. Patient 1 that I'm going to talk about is homozygotic. Both of his alleles have a mutated nonsense codon that leads to 5 extra amino acids in the C-terminus. And that causes a lot of changes in the properties of MDM2. It turns out that our lab and Karen Velsten's lab a few years ago had already discovered that this region of MDM2 is very critical for MDM2 to form homodimers with itself, or heterodimers with MDMX, and those in turn were necessary for MDM2 E3 ligase activity. Then Stefan Uldrigen, who had done the work in Karen's lab, started his own lab, and for a number of reasons, he made this mutation for whatever reason he chose to do. And so he had published a paper that gave us a lot of information. And so it was very exciting to us to have a patient that actually had this mutation. And indeed, when Danny did some experiments with the mutant that generally has these 5 extra amino acids at the end, she found that MDM2, when ectopically expressed, is enormously stable and cannot degrade P53. So you can see wild-type MDM2 can reduce the levels of P53. Not only does the mutant not reduce the levels, they actually increase the levels of P53 in these cells, both ectopic P53 and endogenous P53. MDM2 itself gets stabilized in 1299 cells that lack P53, so it has nothing to do with P53. The mutant itself is inherently more stable. Furthermore, she did half-life analysis, and the mutant is much more stable in these cells. Both MDM2 and P53 are much more stable. And then we were lucky enough to get cells from this patient, and we started to look at those. And we compare them to a control cell line, IMR90. These are normal diploid human fibroblasts. And we found that, indeed, the P53 is significantly more stable in these patients' cells, and the MDM2 is also induced to a greater extent when treated with Nutlin. And then we looked at the lymphocytes from these patients and see massive amounts of MDM2 compared to control lymphocytes. Furthermore, if you look at do immunofluorescence analysis, whereas you see increased P53 only when you treat these cells with Nutlin, you see high levels in these fibroblasts even without treatment. So these patients have very high levels of P53 in them. Also, we did an analysis, a half-life analysis, and again, P53 and MDM2 are more stable in the cells from that, this patient. So, and also the patient cannot stabilize MDM2 to a certain extent because it's already stable. So the problem with this experiment is that is the controls. And the controls are such that we're just getting normal fibroblasts from various sources and comparing them to this patient. And although I'm fairly convinced that there's something very dramatically different about this patient's MDM2 and P53, we're sort of haunted by the fact that we really, it's very hard to find the right controls. And I keep forgetting I have to tell you this before I tell you how we've tackled the control problem. And basically, we've now also looked at the ability of P53 to activate transcription in the patient cells versus the control cells. And it turns out, interestingly, that the P53 that's just sitting in the patient cells is very, very inactive basally compared to the control. But when you activate it with, let's say, Nutlin, or particularly Nutlin, it becomes hyperactive. And so it's basically the fold effect is much greater. But again, there's a control problem. So how we've dealt with that, and I'll just finish the talk with this very quickly, is to take advantage of what is now sort of hot topic in biology now, which is to basically replace the exact replace the wild type MDM2 in its endogenous locus with the mutant. Now, everybody's using CRISPR and Cas, and we're starting to do it too, but this approach to the TALENs is also very effective, and I don't have time to explain it to you other than it's based on homologous recombination and gene editing. And what Yan Zhu in the lab has been doing, she's identified a bunch of tumor-derived MDM2 mutants, and she's replaced them in this particular cell line. She's studying them. It's very interesting. But in collaboration with Danny, she also introduced the patient 1 mutation, the one with the 5 extra amino acids, into these cells. We have cells that contain, basically, it's homozygous, contains 2 MUT1 alleles. Patient, this is from patient 1. Heterozygotes, basically, they have 1 wild type and 1 mutant allele. And then, as a real control, she's actually reintroduced a wild type MDM2 into the same cells. These are U2OS cells that have wild type P53 and, of course, wild type MDM2. So what we've learned is, first of all, that the levels of P53 in the homozygotes are higher than those seen in either the heterozygotes or the wild-type TALs. We've also seen that MDM2 is clearly more actively produced with Nutlin or even with daunorubicin compared to the wild-types. And also, if you do immunofluorescence, you see even more dramatically that P53 is much more expressed in the mutant cells than in the wild-type cells, and even in the heterozygote cells. Furthermore, again, we see that the activity of P53 in particularly the homozygotic cells with this mutation is significantly lower than the control cells, and yet it can be activated, actually a greater fold induction, with either Nutlin or daunorubicin. So this is sort of a working model for what's going on. We think that in a normal cell, P53 is being degraded by MDM2, but there's enough free P53 to have moderate activity. The mutant MDM2 can't degrade P53, but P53 levels go up, but it's bound to MDM, it's bound to the mutant, and so you have lower activity. And then if you treat the cells with either Nutlin, you're going to have moderately increased activity, but relatively increased activity with the mutant. So this is our model. We still really don't understand fully what's happening. I think my prediction is that it's not only a hyperactive P53, but there may actually be extra P53-independent activities of MDM2 that are involved. And this is what we're going to be working on in the future. I just want to finish with, I guess, the Goldilocks hypothesis, which is that if you have too little P53 or mutated P53, you have cancer susceptibility, but too much P53 or hyperactive P53 might actually contribute to premature aging characteristics. So again, as I said at the beginning, anything we learn about the good P53 is going to be important, and anything we learn about the bad P53 is also going to be important. So I think there'll be a lot of things left for young people to do in the future, and I hope that they do it. Thank you very much.
Status of P53 and the P53 pathway in terms of cancer therapy. Years ago, people used gene therapy to try and put it back.
With adenovirus, I might add.
I guess that you mentioned the drug that tried to convert the mutant to a wild type. And then, of course, the lack of P53 was a basis for Frank McCormick's oncolytic virus. What's happening now in terms of, is there anything happening in terms of therapy these days?
I guess there's two things. One thing that I've mentioned repeatedly, which is the idea of Nutlin. So about half of all tumors have mutant P53, another half have wild-type P53, and it's believed that the tumors with wild-type P53 have somehow a repressed version of P53. So if you can find a way to disrupt P53's interaction with MDM2, you're going to have a potentially very powerful therapy. There's a real problem with that. There's two problems with that. First of all, how to make a tumor specific. We know that if you knock MDM2 conditionally out of a mouse, you're going to have, basically massive tumor degeneration and death. The other problem is that if you actually treat a patient that has mutant P53 in its tumor with an MDM2 inhibitor, you're running the risk of having even higher levels of mutant P53. Gigi Lozano, whose name I should have mentioned before repeatedly, has the most beautiful data showing that if you combine a lack of MDM2 with a mutant P53 mouse, you get far more tumors than just having MDM2 there, as if MDM2 is restraining the ability of mutant P53 to produce tumors. So this is going to be a very important aspect of what we call personalized medicine. You're really going to have to know that the genetic profile of the tumor you're treating before you hit it with something that could actually activate the wrong kind of P53. And then I wanted to mention, this is an old story, but it's from Andrei Gudkov. Just as we talk about, finding ways to activate wild-type P53, you actually may want to actually restrain wild-type P53. So drugs that actually inhibit wild-type, in certain conditions like ischemia or certain kinds of things where neurodegeneration, these might actually be very important someday. P53 isn't only good. Yes?
Knock down at different steps of, germination, or does that have differential effects?
Yeah, is this on? Yeah, so that's an important question. What aspect of the mevalonic pathway is important for mutant P53's activity? That's a great question. So the only way you can address that question was to put back into tumors either treat the tumor cells with specific inhibitors of either farnesylation, geranylation, and so on, and then see if you could restore the activity. So what Will found was that adding back cholesterol did nothing. That's a negative result. We can't conclude very much from that. What he did find, though, was that an inhibitor of geranylation acted just like statins, and furthermore, you could restore the negative impact of statins with geranyl pyrophosphate. He could not do this with an inhibitor of farnesylation or putting back farnesyl into whatever it is into cells. So that implies that geranylation is an important component of the mevalonic pathway that is regulated by mutant P53.
In certain hematological malignancies, there's probably a haploinsufficiency as far as P53 goes. One allele is deleted, the other one is intact, and the other allele is not mutated. Can you explain the mechanism of how that would work in terms of its malignant potential?
No, I can't. I think it's really important because there is a tendency, the studies with heterozygotes like that have always been slightly confusing to me. I mean, in a way, it shouldn't make a difference whether there's one or two alleles because of the intimate relationship between P53 and MDM2. But there might be just a change somehow in the balance between the two of them that might somehow predispose in this way. It's a very interesting finding, but basically I don't know how it would inform this.
Yes. So I'm trying to work out the mutations in the DNA binding domain, the countless mutations in the sort of stoichiometry of P53 function. It functions mostly as a tetramer.
Yes.
Does it bind DNA as a tetramer? Does it need to tetramerize?
Does wild-type P53 bind to DNA as a tetramer?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm convinced of it.
Okay. So if you have a heterozygous mutation where you have presumably 50% functional DNA binding domains and 50% non-functional, how many DNA binding domains actually contact DNA in the tetramer?
Actually,
all four of them?
It's a guy named Randall Poon, I think, in Hong Kong, who did a very quantitative analysis of that. In other words, how many mutants does it take to inactivate a tetramer? And he came up with a number that I can't remember what it is. But, I could make it up, but you could look up his paper. But I think the idea is that as a general rule, epidemiologically, the end result of a tumor that has acquired mutant P53, it has almost invariably lost the wild type. So that even if you're dampening wild type activity and bringing it down to a low level, you have enough of it. And as part of the selection process of a tumor, I think you're eventually going to have to get rid of wild type in that setting.
So lamin A is modified by farnesyl, it can be modified by geranyl as well.
Uh-huh.
It interacts.
Did you say lamin A?
Yes.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It interacts with other EPBP, so with the component you discussed. It also is, when mutated, the underlying cause for AGP, Hutchinson-Gilford.
Yes.
So my question is, is P53 linked to lamin A or its processing?
It's a great question, and we don't know the answer to that. All we know is in the cells from that one patient, we don't see any mutation or anything abnormal about lamin A in those cells. But it's a really great question to know whether there's some relationship between P53 and lamin A. I think that's, as a general thing, it would be a great project.
So since people have been on statins for years, has anybody...
You have to unmute yourself.
Since people have been on statins for years, has anybody gone back and looked at the data and say, do they have less tumors?
That's a great question.
Tumors, right? Because they've done that with metformin.
Yeah.
And
yeah. What have they found?
That there are reduced numbers of incidents, right?
So
data has to be there.
If you look at the literature of statins and cancer, I'd say 80% of it's a relatively small literature given how big a field cancer is and how big a field cardiology is. You'd think there'd be more people trying to put these two together.
I think don't talk to cardiologists.
No. No. What I think is that that the majority of the studies indicate that statins could be beneficial, but as is often the case with epidemiological studies, there are some that argue that no, there's no benefit. Of course, as we move into the era of personalized medicine, it's going to be more and more important to figure out what the differences are. And I would argue that maybe having a mutant P53 might make a patient more responsive to statins, because theoretically their tumors might have become more addicted to having high levels of these mevalonic pathway enzymes. That said, we had a rather depressing experience, Will did, when he, of course, with his exhaustive reading, discovered that there was a gigantic study in France of 100,000 patients. It was depressing only because it's amazing how fast it is to lose statistical power. We thought, wow, 100,000 patients, we're going to be golden. So it turns out that they'd followed 100,000 patients for decades, and they knew every little thing about these people, like what they took, what drugs they took, what happened to them, what diseases they had. So we contacted the head of the study, and we had this conversation. We were very excited when we started the phone call and really depressed at the end of it. And the reason we were was because you can do the math. Of 100,000 patients, 50% of them are women. That's 50,000. Of 50,000 of those women, maybe 10% have had breast cancer. Meanwhile, 20% of people in the population take statins. So that's 20% of 10%. Then, of course, let's talk about mutant P53. It turns out, and I should have mentioned this, that mutant P53 is only present in the most aggressive kinds of the basal-like triple-negative breast cancers. So that's 25% of those breast cancers. Basically, at the end of it, we are talking about 50 people, which is, you know, when you go from 100,000 to 50, it's kind of depressing. So we're now Will is trying to set up a prospective study where women presenting with breast cancer will agree to take statins, so you can probably then be much more selective for this kind of a study.
With respect to the mevalonate pathway, bisphosphonates, which have anti-tumoral activities, also work through similar pathway. They inhibit FDPS and GDPS, so farnesylation and geranylation. What do you predict their role would be in
bisphosphonates? Are they the bone straightening?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting thing to look at. Yeah, we should put those into the cultures and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll write that down.
As Philippe said, I have the pleasure of thanking you for coming today.
Thank you.
And I think this has been a wonderful example to students and postdoctoral fellows. You know, P53 is a gene that's been worked on for 30 years. It started off with a kind of murky history at the beginning. They thought it was an oncogene and then found out it was a tumor suppressor. And I think the lesson we've learned today is that 30 years later, there's still an enormous amount of work to do. You and others, though, are still discovering unexpected things about P53 that we thought we'd done to death many years ago. And I think this is a real lesson that we need this focus at the basic level to unearth the new discoveries and understandings of the most prevalent gene in cancer that we clearly don't understand. And so this is really in honor of the work, in your determination to keep working on P53, and we'd like to thank you very much for being the Holmes Lecturer.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Just the McGill ribbon alone is enough for as a gift for me.
You can put it in your hair.
I will.
Oh, for the wine.
Yeah, right.
So thanks very much, everybody.
That's fine.
Thank you.
was great. You know, I sit on this committee with you,
but
you don't know it.
But it's not related.
Are you sure? Absolutely. So you Alan.
Here.
Yeah.
You've got a on the podium, and the controls are here.